Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at efforts to get out the vote in Arizona, particularly for minority voters.
And families with young kids are leaving cities at a rapid pace, continuing a pandemic trend.
But first, this fall, lots of candidates are running for lots of offices up and down the ballot. But we've also seen a number of elected officials call it quits in recent years, from the state legislature to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors to the U.S. Senate. Some of them have cited gridlock as a reason for their departures, saying they couldn't get anything done. Others have said they thought they could be more effective pursuing particular policies outside of government. My next guest has done both, worked as an elected official and as a private citizen. Lisa Graham Keegan served in the state legislature and as superintendent of public instruction. She's also advocated for education policies outside of government. When I spoke with her earlier, I asked if she was really able to tackle the kinds of issues she wanted to tackle while she was in elected office.
I was super lucky for two reasons. First of all, education was a big issue for everybody, and I was able to I became the vice chair in my first term and then the chairman of the committee in my second term. And at that time, Fife Symington was governor, and he had blue ribbon committees on education, and it just was top of everybody's mind. Speaker Hall was my first speaker, which is a huge blessing. She was a great mentor. And then we did manage to ultimately, in my second term, passed some major legislation in 1994. So that was really, really gratifying, and it has had a huge effect over time.
So how do you see the calculation of what office holders, what policymakers, what politicians can do while they are in those offices versus the kind of impact they might be able to have as a private citizen?
Yeah. The number two reason I was lucky, Mark, that I didn't mention was that I was in the majority.
Yeah.
Republicans
were
in the majority in the House. Oh, my gosh. It just made it makes a huge difference. And so because you can set the agenda, et cetera, it is really the case that for me, I think it's really important to know your work. You can't be great at everything. It's impossible. It's too much going on. But you can study particular issues. And I became really fascinated with the possibility of what educators could do, given the freedom, et cetera. And so I also recognized there were going to be some ways and some organizations that probably we were going to need to get started in order to support the movement of educators, teachers, parents in the market, if you will, because we were doing some things in Arizona like public charter schools and open enrollment in the districts, which was causing we thought would produce a disruption, and it has. And there were no outside supports for that. So I was really interested in becoming superintendent to sort of implement the 94 laws, but then also getting outside of that and addressing these things through nonprofit advocacy.
Well, how do you view those different kinds of work? Because it seems to me that there are certain things you can do and certain authority and power you have when you are, for example, superintendent of public instruction.
Yeah.
But I would also imagine there are limitations with what you're able to do when you are in that role.
For sure, Mark. And the superintendent's role is in a lot of ways, it's certainly an executive role. It's an administrative role. It isn't a legislative role.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the benefit of having come from the legislature where I had relationships and I could talk to people there. But it is not the same thing as having a vote. Nothing is like being able to help write law.
I wonder, though, if there are certain things that just being out of elected office altogether
mm-hmm.
help you do that maybe you can't do when you are elected, be it to the legislature or, you know, a more executive role like the state school superintendent.
For sure. I mean, one of the things is when you're in an elective office, there's somebody else who would actually like to be there, who's going to run against you. And that's their right, right? I mean, that's the way it should be. So we should have to be defending ideas all the time. And one of the nice things about being a private citizen is it's not quite as acute. Certainly, there's organizational disagreements, et cetera, and all the things you have to do when you're running an organization or participating with an organization. But, you know, the acute opposition of elective office is you got to want to put up with that, I should say. And that pressure comes off when you get out of elected office and you go work somewhere else. Although, I have to say, the most difficult times I ever had were in nonprofit work that was connected to a political world.
What were the biggest adjustments for you when you left the superintendent's office and went into the kind of advocacy work? Because you stayed in education policy work. Yeah, you're still doing it. So I'm curious what the biggest adjustments were for you when you weren't state school superintendent and you were just Lisa Graham Keegan advocate.
Yeah. Well, I was really lucky because I had Senator John McCain as a mentor, and he ran for president and invited me to help with his education policy team when he was running in 2000 and then again in 2008, Mark. And so that by 2008, I had been out of office for 7 years or so, but I had remained in touch with the work, doing the work in different organizations. And so I still had contact with people across the country that I had known. So the big difference in your ability to do things is, again, really relational.
We've seen over the last few years a number of elected officials in this state decide just to leave office, be it the legislature or other offices. And you occasionally hear from them that they are of the belief that they can have more influence on a particular policy away from the Capitol than they can while they're in elected office. Is that something that has come to your mind? Like, is that something that you would agree with?
Two things, I guess, Mark. Yes, you can have a huge amount of, all of us have power to do things, right? We want to apply enough energy and patience working with other people, et cetera, of course. In the legislative realm, I worry, quite frankly, that people get frustrated with an inability to make progress because we've become so unwilling to talk to the whoever opposes us. I maintain a very strong belief that whatever creation looks like, it probably is about 360 degrees in a sphere of perspective, and you've got one. And you can deny it, but you probably got one. But I think you're obligated to help others understand your perspective and why it might be a good addition to this idea. When you eliminate 180 degrees of perspective from your thinking, the world is not a better place, and Arizona is not a better place.
Are there certain policy areas where you think it might be easier for someone to have more impact outside of government than within?
I mean, yes. Yes, for sure. And you know, I think it's important. For me, my perspective is, as policymakers, you're actually not doing this work. And it's important to remember you have a narrow job. And I think it's critically important to remember what your role is and not to try to do everybody's. And I think that's a danger of being in elective offices. You think you know everything about everybody. You don't actually know much. And you're not doing the work. What you're doing is you're trying to create a legal environment in which people can do the work. They can move ahead with whatever it is they're trying to do. Can they do that by law? Are they free to do that? And on the other side, is our regulatory scheme strong enough so that nothing bad happens? Are we preventing what we ought to be preventing, particularly where children are concerned? And so those things are really, really important, and they're constrained. That it's just policy. You're not doing the actual work. So if you're really interested in the actual work, there's probably going to come a time when you say, okay, well, I was able to contribute to some of this policy. Maybe I'd like to now go take advantage of it. The only thing that I think is a negative is people leaving because, in fact, they can't get a hearing for their ideas, or they just don't think that the system is supportive of their even making an attempt.
All right, Lisa Graham Keegan, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it, too.
During the pandemic, we saw droves of people leaving major cities for places with more space. When you couldn't go near other people, having a yard suddenly sounded nice to a lot of them. But now, new research from the Economic Innovation Group shows the trend hasn't stopped post-pandemic, especially among young families. It's measured by looking at the number of young children in urban centers, which has continued its decline since 2020 and 2021. In Arizona, we saw the same trends in our major cities and some big increases increases in kids age 0 to 5 and other places. I spoke about it all with David Plain, professor emeritus at the University of Arizona School of Geography, Development, and Environment, beginning with a central question. If young families are leaving urban centers, where are they going?
The only category that they looked at where there was increasing numbers of 0 to 4-year-olds were in the exurban parts of metropolitan areas. So it's not just though people moving, it's also that the population's aging, including 0 to 4-year-olds mm-hmm. are becoming 5 to 9-year-olds.
Right. And not so as many 0 to 4-year-olds being born, right?
Yes, exactly. U.S. fertility rates are now at record low levels for our country. And our country is kind of an outlier among developed countries in having had above replacement level fertility up until quite recently. Replacement level fertility means every woman on average replaces herself and one other member of the population. So what's called a total fertility rate of 2.1 is needed, 2.1 children per mm-hmm. woman is needed to replace the population and keep it from shrinking. And the U.S. is now well below that.
Right, right. So birth rates are a factor here.
Yeah.
What else goes into this kind of trend? Like, is this pandemic driven, which so many things are today?
Yeah, the pandemic, what an economist or a demographer might call a period effect, certainly has had all sorts of interesting repercussions, including what we're looking at here, I think. Housing affordability is the other big issue. And of course, COVID affected that as well.
Yes.
But, you know, this trend is not all that new in that as people go through the life course, young adults want to live farther out from the center of cities for economic reasons, because they want more housing space. Mm-hmm. And as you go away from the center of a geographic point, there's just a lot more land available. Hmm. Housing is cheaper as you go farther out.
Right. So we know that narrative, right? That, like, you know, people have kids, they move to the suburbs, they have more space. This was a big trend, though, we saw during the pandemic for people, families that did live maybe in the middle of a city with a yard, but moved to a less urban place where they had lots more space because people really wanted that. Was the pandemic like an accelerator for this kind of trend that we usually see anyway?
Yeah, I think so. We have a second home on the coast of Maine on the island. Hmm. And our island school during the pandemic years, enrollment doubled. It was up to almost 30 kids in the island school. And this year it's down to 14 again.
Wow.
So yeah, there was definitely an effect of people wanting to, you know, some of the worst COVID death rates and so on were in places like New York City and so on early on.
Yeah, that urge to spread out. Let's talk a little bit about some of the Arizona-specific data here and some of the nitty-gritty that I thought was really interesting, actually. Like, we saw in many of the major counties where there are major cities, like in Maricopa and Santa Cruz County and Coconino counties, all saw decreases in that population of kids, you know, really young kids, 0 to 4. But in Pinal County, we saw this really big jump, like 17%, which seems like an anomaly here. What's behind that?
Well, that is the exurban aspect that is part of the study here. It's all about housing affordability, the housing cost gradient. As you get farther and farther out, there's a lot of land available in Pinal County. Pinal County has been one of the fastest growing counties in the U.S. now for several decades, as Phoenix has continued to sprawl farther and farther out. So it's affordable housing, and housing affordability has just been a huge issue for young people.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the effects of this, right? Like, what does it mean for cities, the central cities, which have been, you know, such magnets for so many years now, that young people are, like, kids are not going to be there as much?
Yeah, I've worked off and on at the U.S. Census Bureau. And after the 2010 census, we did a special report where we actually measured all kinds of demographic variables at different distances from what we defined as the center point of metropolitan areas, and then looked at the changes in things like age structure at different distances away from the center and population growth rates and so on. And back then, after the Great Recession, the young people were just flocking through the downtown areas. So we've really reinvented the downtowns of American cities as kind of the fun part of town for young people, and particularly prior to childbearing. That's where the action is. That's where they all wanted to be. Our older daughter in Denver actually bought probably one of the closest to ground zero houses in the Denver metropolitan area, but it only had like 900 square feet.
Yeah.
After their second of their three children were born, they heard the call of the suburbs.
Your own family following these national trends.
Yes.
So let me ask you lastly here, Dave, just about predictions for the future. Like, it seems like in demographics, even when we have big blips like the pandemic, these are sort of trends that are cyclical, that repeat themselves based on generations. So I wonder, like, based on what you've done for your career and the work that you do, what do you think is unique about what's happening right now in our demographics that might look a little different and not repeat these trends in the same way in the future?
Yeah, I think things are going to slow down a little bit in that regard. The U.S. has a very unusual age structure as a result of the post-World War II baby boom, mm-hmm. the baby boomers, those of us in that generation, you know, are now retiring in big numbers. But our kids, what demographers would call the baby boom echo, but maybe more popularly known as millennials, mm-hmm. that was actually the biggest generation in American history. Where we are now for young families is what I would call the baby bust echo. So during the 1970s, it was a very small generation following the big baby boom generation. And we're now at the echo of the baby bust. And so I think there's going to be less of these fluctuations going forward in the future. One thing that's been going on with young people, though, is their migration has been highly focused on some amenity-rich places where they really wanted to live for lifestyle reasons. And so we've had, you know, severe housing shortages in part of the country, whereas in other parts of the country, you know, they're kind of desperate for people at this point. So things are going to be different in the future.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. All right. Dave Plain, Professor Emeritus at the University of Arizona School of Geography, Development and Environment, joining us to shed some light on these demographic shifts. Dave, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the lead vocalist of Blonde Redhead often talks about the love-hate relationship she has with her two bandmates, why the 90s alt-rock band is still touring after 3 decades of making music.
But first, today is the last day to register if you want to vote in November. So if you haven't done it yet, now is your last chance. So we're going to spend some time this morning talking about efforts to get people to register and vote in this election. Our producer, Ayanna Hamilton, went out to find volunteers working to get potential voters registered.
Are you
ready
to vote?
Yes.
Excellent. When's the last time you checked?
Yesterday.
Last week. And especially people who have been like registered here or voting here for a long time, they are just like, oh, I'm on the list. And I think what we're trying to do is make sure that everyone's really double, triple, quadruple checking.
That's what
you don't want to
check.
Exactly. You don't want to get to, you know, October 8th and then it's too late and you're realizing, oh no, now I don't get to vote.
Do you plan on getting registered?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Do we have any more of the registration forms?
We do.
Yeah.
But she's just like, you know, it doesn't matter if we vote because like, bad people still end up, you know, doing what they want.
That's a big issue, too. So many people, they don't feel like voting, or they feel like their vote doesn't matter, doesn't count, nothing's going to change, but it does change. Things do change.
So now let's focus in on two groups that are becoming increasingly important in our neck-and-neck swing state. There are millions of dollars and countless volunteers on the ground in Arizona courting the Latino vote here. Latino voters now make up a third of the state's population, and more than 855,000 of them are expected to vote here. But when it comes to Black voters in Arizona, the story is about disenfranchisement and what happens when a group feels their vote doesn't always matter. I spoke more about it this morning with Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, and columnist Greg Moore. And we began with Elvia Diaz and Latino voters. She went out door knocking recently with Mi Familia Vota and told me it's a tough job.
We went out, as I do every single day, in a very, very hot day in Phoenix. So I can tell you that it was miserable. and this is really nothing new. What has surprised me here this year is the intensity of what is being done, you know, that you mentioned there in the intro, the millions of dollars that has been spent on this effort and the amount of people out, you know, from paid workers to tons of volunteers across the state, not just here in Phoenix. You know, I happen to go in the Phoenix neighborhood, but they are everywhere. You know, they are targeting Pima County. You know, they're also targeting another group, you know, which is the Native Americans. So it is happening everywhere and it's happening aggressively. Something I haven't seen, I will say, for a while since SB 1070 or other waves of engagement. And I see it this year.
Yeah, yeah. And they're not necessarily like asking for voters to vote for one candidate or one issue, but it's part of, as you say, this massive effort to get Latino voters out in Arizona as we're looking at this swing state, this very tight election. Both campaigns are obviously trying to get that Latino vote. And it sounds like, Elvia, it's not necessarily a lock for Democrats anymore.
Well, yes, absolutely. And that's why it's happening. So, yes, no, you are correct. This organization in particular, Mi Familia Vota, and other organizations that I have come to, they're nonpartisan and they are just providing information. But they are, the campaigns themselves are being very aggressive and that there are separate efforts. You know, I mentioned something like, you know, the Harris campaign has spent like $7 million, you know, specifically targeting Latinos. And so they're doing it with TV and digital ads, but also knocking on doors. Those are very targeted, right? They are asking people to vote for, you know, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, because that campaign is also doing that kind of work. Representative Ruben Gallego, for instance, has been incredibly aggressive targeting the Latino vote. You know, he has gone to mega soccer games doing so, town halls in Spanish, all kinds of things to do it. So really, again, what has impressed me is the magnitude and how big the effort is to really get the Latino vote, because they, one, everyone knows that, you know, Latinos don't vote just one way, right? We run the gamut. And so it is impressive to see that it appears that both parties and a lot of candidates are finally understanding that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then, Greg, I want to turn to you and talk about the people that you talked to about turning out the Black vote in Arizona. It sounds like they're focusing on Gen Z and on voters who don't usually vote.
Yeah, which I think is pretty neat. You know, the longer you're around everyday working class Black people, the more you start to realize that there are folks who just would rather not participate in the system at all. There are people out there who are just like, look, this isn't for me. It's never been for me. I've never voted. I'm never going to vote. And there are folks out there who are actually looking to get those people to say, hey, listen, this is for you, but it's going to take all of us. And the folks I spoke to are reaching out in some really interesting ways, particularly to get younger voters, millennials and Gen Z. They're going to the bar, they're going to the state fair. They're just trying to meet people where they are. One activist I spoke to said, look, we're not trying to speak to folks who are already woke. Yes, yes, we want them to vote, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to get people who are sleeping to be awake. I thought that was a super interesting strategy.
Talk a little bit about where that comes from, that sense of disenfranchisement among this community in particular. It sounds like it's pretty deep-seated.
Well, yeah, for sure. Take a look at a politician like Kyrsten Sinema, right? She's a Democrat, supposedly, and then she turns around and then doesn't do what people want her to do on voting rights, right? Or they'll say, look, we voted in Barack Obama, we voted in Joe Biden, but my life didn't change. So clearly the game is rigged. Clearly, these are two wings of the same bird. You know, the Democrats and Republicans say that they're different, but in reality, they're just trying to hold on to power for the super wealthy, the super rich. What the activists are saying is, listen, we've got some successes that we can point to. And if you help us and then stay engaged after the election, we believe that your life can be different by working within the system. And it's a compelling argument, assuming people are open to hearing it.
Are people open to hearing it?
Yeah, some are. But the trick is you can't just parachute in and just argue with somebody the day you want them to register. The trick is you've got to kind of be embedded in it and to build some trust within that community before you start asking them to do anything. Mm-hmm. Right? You got to show up every day. And you really do have to point to some successes. There was one group I spoke with called One Arizona. It's an umbrella organization that actually started off as kind of like a Latino group in the wake of SB 1070, but it's since branched out in reaching out to, you know, Native American populations, Black populations, just anybody who's working class, working poor. And we know that those groups tend to be overrepresented by minorities. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, look, let me show you what we've done so far. And let me show you what we can do if we all stick together and continue to vote.
Yeah.
And you know what? One of the things that I'm hearing from a lot of readers that don't like that we are highlighting minorities, that why are African Americans and Latinos special, right? And my reply is that no, we're not. However, we are not being paid attention to throughout the year and throughout the decades and through history. So we are like any other voter. I mean, look how much money is being spent to try to convince Republican women, rural voters, working voters. Why does anyone think that minorities don't need that kind of spending to encourage them to vote, to get them out, and to really have a conversation in contact throughout the year, not just on election day or whenever, you know, the candidates need us to vote?
That's really interesting. I want to ask you both this question in terms of issues, right? Like, we assume, you know, Black voters might care about this issue. We assume Latino voters might care about this issue. But from the people you talk to who are really trying to get these voters out to the polls this year, what are voters worried about?
You know, that's the perfect word, Lauren. Assume. We must assume nothing, right? And there's no substitute than talking to voters. So you hear the candidates and you hear us in the media talk a lot about, for instance, border security, immigration. And yeah, to some folks, that's very, very important.
Yeah.
But I will say most of the people that I talk to and, you know, most of the emails that I get to from Latinos are not about immigration. It's really about, you know, daily life, having a job, you know, how are they going to pay for groceries, gas, all the stuff that you hear about. Mm-hmm. Reproductive rights, you know, it seems to be important as well. So it is not what we in the media and the candidates are saying. It's really just about making it on a daily basis.
Yeah. Jobs, abortion, rent, affordable housing, inflation, groceries, gas prices. Yeah, just, I'm with Elvia, just everyday concerns, policing, mm-hmm. everyday concerns.
Yeah. All right. That is columnist Greg Moore, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, Elvia Diaz. Thank you both for coming on and talking about this. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Today is the last day to register. Monday is the last day to register to vote.
And with that, thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Today is, of course, October 7th, which marks the one-year anniversary of the cross-border attack by Hamas militants into Israel. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, it has been a tumultuous year since that attack. Where are we now?
Well, it really has. It's been a really tumultuous year, kicked off, as you say, by the nearly 1,200 people killed, 250 taken hostage by Hamas exactly a year ago. This morning, we saw President Isaac Herzog of Israel joining a memorial service, which began shortly after daybreak, and that was at the scene of the Nova Music Festival. And it marked the moment that festival came under attack. And we should remember 350 people were murdered at that site. And of course, they were young people, which partly explains the enormous trauma that Israel felt as a result of all of this. It was described at the time as Israel's 9/11. The British Prime Minister today, paying tribute to the victims, said it was the worst day in Israel's history. And Jewish history, indeed, since the Holocaust. And other world leaders have echoed that sort of sentiment. So it's memorials today in Israel, but also elsewhere in the world. I was hearing of memorials in Australia for this, for example. Earlier on today, we've got memorials here in Britain. It's a worldwide reflection of what really happened in Israel, the tragedy that befell those people a year ago. I should say there's more information today about what's going on. So we know, for example, that Hamas has fired more rockets from Gaza today, aimed at Tel Aviv. The Israeli military say several of those rockets were intercepted. We also know that there have been rockets fired by Hezbollah across the border into northern Israel. Indeed, last night, there was an attack on Haifa, the port city of Haifa, the Israeli port city of Haifa, in which a number of people were injured. So it's not a settled situation at all. The fighting very much goes on in and with Hamas in Gaza, in and with Hezbollah, also Iranian-backed, in Lebanon. And of course, Iran itself is absolutely central to all of this. Israel says it will conduct a reprisal for Iran sending those, 200 ballistic missiles at Israel last week. And indeed, a BBC reporter over the weekend, I heard, said Israel is actually fighting, if you count them up, is fighting on 7 fronts at the moment. So any idea that this is calming down or is reaching some sort of solution just does not appear to be backed up at all. And that's despite, you know, enormous efforts, for example, by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who has been going to the Middle East again and again and again, as you know, over the year to try and forge some sort of ceasefire, some kind of a peace plan, and it simply hasn't been forthcoming. So it has been in every way a tumultuous year.
Indeed. And so, Rob, despite all of that fighting going on, the Nobel Peace Prize will be awarded this coming week, along with other Nobel Prizes. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, so every October we have the Nobel Prizes awarded. So we've just had actually the Medicine Prize awarded today, and it was awarded to 2 American scientists. And by the way, the 4 of the Nobel Prizes are awarded by Swedish institutions. But the Peace Prize, which is the biggest of all of them and is awarded on Friday of this coming week, that is awarded by Norway. So this week we will see the Physics Prize tomorrow. We'll see Chemistry on Wednesday. We'll see Literature on Thursday, which is always interesting. And then the Peace Prize itself on Friday. And of course, it's always been or in many, many cases, been controversial, particularly the Peace Prize. So last year, it was an Iranian human rights activist who got the prize in prison in Iran. She is a firm proponent of women's rights in Iran, which is a huge issue there, of course. Back in 2009, of course, we all remember President Obama getting it. Even though he'd been in office for just 12 days before the end of the nominating process, and people at the time wondered if that was a fair moment to be awarding him the Peace Prize. It was more about what he promised, less about what he'd actually achieved in office, I think would be a fair summary. But anyway, in the Nobel Prizes this week, and we'll be looking forward to seeing how they pan out.
Absolutely. All right, Rob, finally, let's end with something a little lighter in China, where there's apparently a collecting craze of wild mushrooms. What's going on there?
Yeah, now this is interesting. We're very lucky at the BBC. We have a department called BBC Monitoring, and they monitor media and social media around the world in local languages. So in China, it's Mandarin, and you know, Hong Kong, it's Cantonese, and so on. Well, on Friday, they picked up that there is a major kind of mushroom foraging craze going on in China right now. What's happening is people are going to Sichuan province, Yunnan province, which is in the southwest of China. The rainy season there is June to September, and the mushrooms have been coming out in profusion, and people are going out foraging and collecting them. They're then photographing them or videoing them, putting them up on their social media channels and so on, and sharing them. And so there's kind of competition for the rarest types of mushroom, for the greatest sort of design and color and all that kind of thing. And it really is genuinely a sort of craze that's kind of taken off. In fact, I was reading that if you're a guide and you know where the mushrooms are and you're prepared to guide people there, set yourself up as a guide in Yunnan province, you can earn up to $15,000 a month.
Wow.
Just doing that at the moment. So interestingly, an unusual story, a quirky story. And of course, you know, the Chinese have been foraging for mushrooms for years, for centuries. But this is a real kind of social media driven craze at the moment that is involving a lot of people, not least because there was a public holiday in China in the last week or so, and that brought even more people out foraging for mushrooms.
Very interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Blonde Redhead's music has been described as three-dimensional haunted house whimsy. The band formed in 1993, and their time together has always been somewhat fraught. Singers Kazu Makino and Amadeo Pache have been both romantic and songwriting partners. Makino once sustained a horseback riding injury that damaged her head so badly she had to relearn how to sing. But through it all, the band has consistently earned glowing reviews from the most discerning critics, publications like Pitchfork and Stereo Gum. Blonde Redhead plays the Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix tonight, and as Makino told the show's Sam Dingman, for her, music is about something bigger than keeping the band together.
I think I owe it to music that I was able to survive also, like, you know.
Wow.
Like this, like especially like outer situation, life, condition, environment. Mm-hmm. I didn't choose to be born in Japan. I didn't choose my name. You know, like just things like that. Many people didn't choose to find themselves in certain circumstance, but your inner strength or your inner kind of navigation would keep you surviving, you know?
That's really profound. I hadn't thought about that before, that there are these ways in which songwriting, or maybe just making art generally, is something that you have some measure of control over, and it helps you. I know we aren't necessarily always in control of the art that we make, but it's a way of applying control to circumstances in our life that we did not choose or can't control.
Yeah. It's almost like all the things that you accumulate inside you, including sort of, you know, whatever the toxic things and poisonous things and whatever, that could all be released through music, which is really great way to deal with I think challenges.
Yeah. You know, that idea that of not necessarily being in control of the music, it makes me think of a quote of yours I read that I wanted to ask you about. You were talking about performing live, and you said you go into another dimension.
I mean, ideally, we don't always succeed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel. Sometimes you could be in the right place and right moment, and there's sort of the sense that something is lifting you up, and you get to kind of almost leave your own body, like, you know, or you become, you know, uninhibited, you know, like I'm extremely awkward, like a shy individual, I find myself, you know, and for me to play music is like a great way to relate to outside world, I suppose, and then you'd be less shy, you know.
Yeah. Can I ask, does the person you are when you're performing music and you have that interdimensional feeling, does it feel like the same person that you are when you're not playing music, or does it feel like two different people?
Well, it's complicated, you know. Sometimes I feel so at ease about playing music, but it doesn't feel like I'm doing it. Like I hear myself and it sounds so strong, but then is it really me that I'm singing? You know, I feel almost like a microphone is doing the job, because I never ever sing off stage. Sometimes I go days without saying anything, you know, just at times like, I feel like even if I stop singing, the microphone will keep going.
Wow. There's another line from the latest record, Sit Down for Dinner, that I wanted to ask you about that really just hit me very hard. I kind of can't stop thinking about it, actually. The line is, we all had plans before when we got hit.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the backstory of that lyric?
I think it happened so much, you know, something catastrophic. It could be 9/11, it could be pandemic, it could be, you know, Gaza invasion. It seems that right now we're like in a generation or era that we're just having like successive historical events. It almost feels unfair that this generation or this era, it's such a historical, huge, catastrophic, but succession of them, it feels like to me.
Yeah, yeah. That makes me think again of one of my, probably my favorite song from the record, actually, which is Rest of Her Life.
Yeah.
It's a really, really beautiful song. And there's this idea of the main character in the song, who I assumed was you, talking about leaving one chapter behind and walking on. You say she walks without you.
Yeah.
What was that? Were you thinking about anything in particular with that song related to what we've been talking about?
Yeah. The longer you live, the more things you lose. Mm-hmm. And the more you have, the more you experience, you know, beautiful things, that you also have higher and higher risk of losing them, the things that matters to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the way that it is. But nobody warn you about that, right? Like as you get older, It's not something that you think about when you're a little child.
Right. Well, I guess as a last question, you know, we've been talking so much about these things that happen in life that you can't choose.
Yeah.
And using music as a way of processing the impacts of those things and how difficult it is to move on from them. You know, I know that you've said over the years that for Blonde Redhead, being a band is not always easy. You guys have dealt with a lot of upheaval and tumultuousness. You've even said, I believe, that this most recent record is probably the last one you'll make. And yet, here you are, a year after the record came out, still on tour, still making the music, and for decades now, you guys have chosen, even in the midst of all of this, to keep being a band and to keep this thing consistent.
Yeah.
Tell me about where you are with all that in this moment.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, like we were talking about, like, you really, you know, this was not my plan, but, you know, your plan goes out the window because world is, it throw you into this like scenario, the situation that you did not see it coming at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that you deal with it in a small ways, you deal with it. My small way was to keep writing songs and to release this album. But, you know, I had no anticipation that that anybody would want to listen to this, you know, like I've always put everything that I have at the time into music. You do your very best. And whether we like it or not, we know we are built to play music, guys.
Yeah.
It seems like that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kazu Makino is one of the three members of Blonde Redhead, playing tonight at Crescent Ballroom here in Phoenix. Kazu, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.